Hi, welcome to the Bowen Buzz podcast. I'm your host, Chris Reed, and I'm talking the buzz on Bowen therapy for therapists, clients, educators, or anyone interested in the soft tissue industry. The show where we get to meet interesting Bowen practitioners, trainers, and where we get to hear from experts sharing their secrets to assist Bowen therapists growing their businesses and growing their lives. Welcome to the Bowen Buzz. So today we get to talk to Joanne Clark. Joanne is an NLP practitioner and master prac trainer, but I know Joanne mainly as a business coach. So I thought it'd be a great opportunity to have a chat with Joanne because Joanne presented at our conference in October last year in Cairns and was one of the main presenters there. But a great opportunity to talk to Joanne around NLP and how it pertains to the language that we as health professionals use to our clients. Welcome, Jo.
Well, thanks, Chris.
But first of all, Jo, could we go back a step? Because you have done lots of things in the past and worked in the corporate world as well. So
yes.
Could you go back a step for us and just let us know perhaps where you started, how you got started in working in the corporate world and which led you to where you are today?
Yeah, sure. I have a degree, an honours degree in sociology, and that's a very solid research base that I built there with lots and lots of statistical analysis. I also did psychology whilst I was a student. So I did an undergraduate psych degree. And later on, I moved into doing more management sort of work. But I suppose my initial work was in community development. And my initial professional work was in community development, where I was looking at children and family services in the southern region of Melbourne. So it took in six local government areas, and it was a comprehensive overview of family and children services. And I worked with those six local governments around developing services, and sometimes that meant forming partnerships and negotiating agreements that crossed boundaries. And the services we were looking at were all children and family services, so maternal and child health, child care, before and after school care, vacation care, as well as special needs services, so for children with disabilities, foster care, a whole gamut. I then moved into local government, and I worked initially for the Shire of Cranbourne, and I was in local government when we had the Jeff Kennett
big shake up.
So the amalgamation and realignment of local governments, and Shire of Cranbourne amalgamated with the city of Berwick, and became the city of Casey. And I was the family and children's services manager for the city of Casey. So there I was in charge of 42 maternal and child health services, four child care centres, an occasional care centre, lots of before and after school care, holiday, and all the kindergarten services as well, and neighbourhood houses, looked after the neighbourhood house program. I had 145 staff in my team, and around 2,000 contracted family day carers also were working for us at the City of Casey.
So you're directly managing a lot of people and
yes.
their issues, who are then looking after thousands of other people.
Yes.
And so working with that as well. So you've had a big exposure
yeah.
to lots of, well, whether it be issues within families, and also people and staff. So
yeah.
did that become an area of expertise for you, managing staff and managing the, well, with the staff, anyone that has staff knows that every staff member comes with their own strengths and challenges.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I had to, because I was managing such a large number of people, I had to be quite innovative in finding management strategies that worked. And also because a lot of my staff were remote from where I was located, so they were in preschools or in maternal and child health centres, finding ways to effectively manage those teams was a great learning opportunity for me. And I really did love working with all those people, because for me as a manager, my main role was to ensure that they were in a position where they could deliver the best quality service to families. And to do that, I had to ensure things like that they had the resources they required, that the facilities were designed in a way that enhanced their capability to provide the service, and that when their issues, you know, because all of them have lives as well, so if they had issues arising for them, health issues or family issues, that the supports were in place to ensure they could have the space and the time to deal with their issues whilst not impacting adversely on the clients that they were working with.
And with those early experiences working with people and managing staff, is that where you got, you gained an interest in language and the way that what language can mean with people? Is that, was that the first sort of inkling? Were you looking for something perhaps, do you think, in your professional life then?
Yeah, I do think for me it was, it was communication, you know, in some ways is a bit of a mystery because I say something and then someone hears it, and what they make it mean might be something totally different.
Right.
And I think most people go through life being surprised that someone heard something from them that they don't actually think they said.
Right.
So I was always fascinated by how in a meeting with my team, I could say something, I could give some instructions or outline a new procedure or a new policy, and then the 45 people in the room could go out and there could be 45 different interpretations about what happened.
Right.
So I was fascinated by that. I was also very, very interested in, I suppose, when I did sociology, a big, you know, fashionable, trendy part of sociology at that time was something called labelist theory.
Mm.
So looking at the labels that are that are assigned to people or to groups of people, and then the impact of having that label, the impact it has on the way other people interact with them. So, for example, if someone was labelled as difficult or disabled or, you know, in some way challenged, then the expectations of the community around them changed. And perhaps people lowered their expectations. And it became almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
And there was quite a lot of sociological research done in the 80s around the impact of labelling people and how that impacted the whole community and the way they then interacted socially and what opportunities they took up. So, for example, you know, we do categorise people. It's an efficient way for us to
You
manage.
Mean subconsciously we do that?
Yeah, yeah. And even consciously we do it. Mm. Like, for instance, way back in the day when we used to do streaming in schools. So they used to say, oh, these children are bright, so they'll go in the A class, and these children, maybe not so bright, they'll go in the B class. And these ones, well, you know, we're just going to, it really, they're not bright at all, so they're going to go in the C class and we're going to stream them by ability. What wasn't recognised at the time was often the streaming was actually based on different cognitive development stages.
Right.
So if you're streaming children in primary school, they don't all simultaneously suddenly be able to read. So it is a cognitive development phase. So some might be reading a lot by the time they're four, and some might be reading a lot by the time they're seven.
Mm.
But it doesn't actually mean anything about their intelligence.
Right.
You know, but because we categorise, we were then denying those children who perhaps were going to be good readers by seven, we were putting them into a disadvantaged group and then lowering our expectations of what they could achieve, which perpetuated the myth that they weren't good learners.
Right. So maybe we should do a bit of self-checking of ourselves when we do label or categorise people that we meet.
Exactly right. Because the label's convenient for us
and
it helps us, but when the label becomes a prescription rather than a description, that's when you really want to be wary. And you can see that more and more now when you look at things in psychiatry. So the categorisation of people into different psychiatric diagnoses, you know, like someone with OCD or someone with autism, and we're redefining what it means to be autistic. Nowadays, you know, the definition of autism is vastly different to what it was 20 years ago. I mean, 20 years ago, to be diagnosed autistic, basically, you probably had extremely limited language.
Right.
and never, ever made eye contact with other people. Mm. Now I meet children all the time and the parents are telling me, oh, yes, he's autistic. And the child's making eye contact and communicating effectively. And I kind of wonder, what's the use of the label?
Yes.
Who does it help? Who does it serve?
Because it's better to say that perhaps there's a range of autism, or there's extreme ends, isn't there? So you can sort of, but if we want to give it, but as you say, is it worthwhile to put a label on that child anyway?
That's right. Because what happens with language and is the definitions, it, like at one point of time we might have had 100 words to describe children with different behavioural, with different behaviours. So we might have had, you know, naughty,
annoying.
challenging, you know, and we might have had, you know, someone who's shy, someone who's got a short fuse and gets angry, someone who can't sit still, likes to move around a lot, and someone who, you know, has a short attention span. And nowadays, that's all autistic.
Right, we just lump them into the one big bucket.
And then we treat them all the same.
Right.
Yeah? Oh, autistic. Okay, so now we know they're autistic. So autistic people we do this with and we do this with.
Right.
Whereas previously we had a refined, precise descriptor. And so our responses to the naughty child were different perhaps to our responses to the child who couldn't sit still.
Yeah.
So by collapsing and categorising people and using one label to describe an array of behaviours or an array of issues, or in health, an array of illnesses, by collapsing it into one, we lose power to distinguish and potentially tailor treatment or tailor intervention to suit that individual.
Right. Well, that's a great segue into where we're going today with today's discussion, perhaps around NLP, because you're talking about language there already. So can we just go, often we hear the term NLP, or people may have heard of the term, but not really know exactly what it is. Could you just give us a bit of a background on NLP itself? Is that
sure. So it originated in the 1970s in the US. And there were three prime drivers. So there was that was studied for NLP. So there was Milton Erickson, who was a psychiatrist, and he was renowned as the father of hypnosis. There was Fritz Perls, who was a psychoanalyst, who was also he was renowned for family therapy and psychoanalysis. Yeah. And then there was a woman called Virginia Satir, who was a psychologist, and she was renowned for her family therapy interventions. These three people were masters in their field, and yet all of their approaches were quite, quite different. In fact, you could say almost that Milton Erickson's interventions, his strategies for intervention, and Virginia Satir's interventions were almost at the opposite ends of the spectrum.
Right.
So Milton Erickson, his language and conversation, in terms of it being hypnotic,
right,
which was his expertise area, was very abstract and vague. Whereas Virginia Satir would recover things that people were perhaps deleting or distorting and no longer remembering. She would recover that by diving into very specifics around a situation. So, for example, Virginia Satir would say to someone, if they said, oh, that person doesn't like me, she would say, how specifically do you know that? And if you said, well, you know, it's the way they look at me, and say, well, what specifically is it about how they look at you that has you make it mean they don't like you? So she's
really drilling down.
Drill down till you kind of get to, well, I don't know why I think that. Yeah, or she might flip it and she might say, so when they move their face in that way, it always means they don't like you. Is that right? Do they do that to other people? Does that mean they don't like them too? So she's getting you to consider that the evidence you've collected to prove you're right, that someone doesn't like you, might not be as ironclad as you thought. Contrasting that to Milton Erickson, where Milton Erickson is talking much more about using metaphors and abstract concepts. So he would be talking about it's a good thing to wonder if someone likes you. Yeah.
Okay. So do these people collaborate to come up with NLP, or?
So what happened was there were people who studied these masters.
Right.
So because they were masters in their field and getting amazing results with clients that other people had just written off, they said, how are they doing that? So that Richard Bandler and John Grinder were two researchers who went and studied these masters. And there was a whole group of people from Santa Cruz University who went and studied masters in their field. And then they and in the 70s, as we did in the 70s, because it was a bit of an interesting time, they made thousands and thousands of hours of video recordings. And so, for instance, with Milton Erickson, they looked at all the language patterns that he used in his hypnosis. And then they said, okay, so if someone else does exactly what Milton Erickson does, will they get the same results as him? So they're saying, is there a recipe here that we can copy and other people can use so they can get the same results as him with clients? So they started out by testing out the recipe. And Milton Erickson, you know, he was in a wheelchair because he had, I believe, polio as a child. And so so they'd have someone in a wheelchair with the glasses that Milton Erickson used to wear and the purple velvet jacket he used to wear, doing Milton Erickson language with clients and seeing if they got the results that he got. And then they took away the wheelchair and used the language patterns, and then they took away the jacket, and then they took away the glasses, and then they changed the language patterns and said, oh, that didn't work, so they put the language pattern back in. So they actually tested what was it about Milton Erickson's work that was the difference that made the difference in terms of the results he was getting with his clients. And from that, they were able to write a recipe book of strategies that if you learn, you can use. So at that stage with NLP, it was all based on observational research and testing. So the focus is very much on how to do it, not on why.
Right.
Not on why it works. It's on how it works. And for me, particularly in the area of Bowen therapy, when I think of Tom Bowen, in some ways, the way people have learnt Bowen therapy from Tom Bowen's work is the same model. So people studied how he did it. They didn't know why it worked.
No, we're still working on that.
That's right. They said, how did he do it? And then they said, he's doing this and he gets this result. So if we do the same thing, will we get the same result? Yeah?
That's right.
And sometimes you did. And then sometimes people varied it a bit and they said, well, that didn't work. And so they'd go back to doing it Tom's way.
That's right.
Yeah? And so it's learning by modelling.
Right. Okay.
And that's what NLP is based on, learning by modelling, going to the master, working out how the master did it, copying the master, model the master, and keep practicing and modelling and modelling and modelling until you get the results they get. And you don't mess with the model until you're getting the results they get. Yeah? Then you may decide to enhance it in some way or to bring your own artistry into it. Yeah? Because you are a master of what's already been developed.
Right.
So, but until you're getting the results, don't mess with
that. That's right. It's a bit like paint by numbers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Until you can actually create a masterpiece of your own, which takes time and experience and perhaps thousands of people to talk to really practice your skills that you learn.
Exactly.
So NLP is neuro-linguistic programming, is that correct?
Yep. Yes.
So, okay. So it's around about how our brain understands language. Is that exactly right?
Neuro isn't just about the brain. Mm-hmm. It's about the whole neurological system in the body.
Yep.
Because if we, in a way, I describe it like your brain, your body is electrically wired. It runs on electric circuitry, yeah?
Yep.
So there's messages that are being transmitted from the brain all the way through the circuits of your body, yeah? And so when we think a thought, there's an energy exchange,
yes.
And then that energy is transmitted to where it needs to go,
yep.
In order to achieve an action or another thinking, another thought or an emotion, or, you know, some other thing we're aiming for. So with neuro-linguistic programming, you're looking at the patterns that people have in the way they think, yeah? So that in language, we can hear a code which tells you about the way someone thinks. And when you learn the code, you can discover things like, a person has a belief that they don't even know they have.
Mm-hmm.
And they're living their life as though that belief is as real as the chairs we're sitting on right now.
Right.
Yeah? Because it's an unconscious belief. So they live as if it's true. Now, if that belief works for them, rock on, keep it.
Mm.
But if the belief doesn't work for them anymore, you want to know how to change that circuit.
So if that's a limiting belief, it's stopping them from moving forward.
Yes.
You can then help them change that belief?
Yes.
As in bring it up and say, look, this is something that you hold, and they go, oh, yes, it is. But then you can help them to change that by changing the language they use around that. Is that what you mean? Or?
You might change the language, yeah. And sometimes they're not even aware they believe it.
Mm.
So there are techniques you can use. And this is particularly important, I believe, in health, in the
yes,
health area,
yes.
Right? Because sometimes it's not appropriate to confront someone with their belief. So if someone, for instance, believes that, I don't know, some of the older generation have some beliefs like if they have a diagnosis of cancer, I know my father used to have a belief that if he had surgery and oxygen got to it, then he was a goner.
Right.
Right?
If they opened him up and they'd say, oh, yep.
Yep.
Right.
So that the treatment for it, the surgery for it, would actually aggravate it.
Right.
Yeah? He had that belief.
Mm.
Now, if he was in a situation where he needed to have surgery, that belief wasn't going to work for him anymore.
No.
Yeah?
Yeah?
The technique that you would use in NLP for that is you would reframe it. So I would be, in that instance, just in conversation or, you know, in a newspaper articles or on the news or something like that, bringing to my father's attention that cancer was a disease state that was anaerobic. It doesn't like oxygen. It thrives better in a low oxygen environment.
That's right. Mm.
And the more oxygen it's exposed to, the harder it is for it to survive.
Mm.
And so I would be planting that seed over and over again in just casual conversation and pointing out to him, bringing articles and showing him and talking about it and saying, I heard something on the radio, or just bringing it to his attention. And that way I'm shaking up his belief.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not saying, do you know you believe this?
Mm. Mm.
Because it's an unconscious belief.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm just shaking up, making that belief a bit wobbly, if you like. And then in a situation where perhaps if he did need to have the surgery, I could then remind him of all that information. Well, this will be good because that means more oxygen will get in. And we all know what happens when oxygen gets in, don't we? Because cancer cells don't like oxygen. They're anaerobic. And he would be going, yeah, you're right. That's right.
I have heard that somewhere. right. But you plant the seed. Yeah.
So that's an example of, and I mean, obviously in a personal relationship, you have lots of opportunities
to
do that. Yeah.
But it is incredibly important, isn't it? And the health professionals can almost do a lot of damage to their clients by using language incorrectly or inappropriate language or not really thinking about the way they use language and the words they use in a consultation.
Yes. And if you think about the fact that the people learn fastest when they're in an emotionally aroused state.
Right.
So if you, like, you know, the evidence that people can learn things in an instant is if you've ever worked with someone who's been in a motor vehicle accident, hear the screech of brakes, and they have this whole full-on response to it. And in the future, every time they hear the screech of brakes, their body has this whole physiological reaction.
Yep.
Because they've learned in an intense emotional experience that this is the way to respond to a screech of brakes, right? So that's an imprinted, learnt response. Now, when people come to you in pain, they're in an aroused emotional state. What you say to them becomes an imprinted reaction. So if you say, it's bad, it's going to take a long time to get rid of this, they believe you unconsciously. You are prescribing it to them. Yeah? What if it didn't take a long time? Because for some people it might not. So rather than telling them what it will be like, what if instead you said, well, we can see how this goes. We know that it will improve. For some people, that might be quick, and for others, it might take a while. But the thing is, your body will know the best pace to heal at.
Right. That's interesting. I had a lady come in yesterday, and she said to me, you know, people often talk about diseases running in their family. And I said to this lady, have you decided that, have you? She said, oh, I suppose I have. Maybe I shouldn't decide that that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's a great example, Chris. Mm. That's a great example. Because imagine the limiting belief. If you think, am I in the family? This is the question the unconscious mind says. Am I in the family? Yes.
Yes.
Does diseases run in my family? Yes.
Therefore, okay. I'm going to suffer from this disease.
Yeah.
It's almost like you almost manufacture that disease. The body doesn't know, does it?
No. And you've got the genes to be able to turn it on.
Mm.
You know, like if you've got the genetic inheritance, you can certainly activate that pathway.
Mm.
Yeah. But wouldn't it be more powerful to say, well, what if I chose a different one? Yeah. What if I started to notice the people in the family who don't have the disease? How do they do that?
And it's like, yes, we often get elderly people in who come in and they say, well, I've been to the doctor, and the doctor basically says, well, I'm getting older, and therefore I need to expect to have pain.
Yes.
And, you know, so if the doctor plants that seed that you should expect to have pain, well, you will more likely have pain.
Absolutely.
But, you know, that just limits so much of what they can do. And I think, you know, sometimes as Bowen therapists, if we can say to people, it doesn't necessarily have to be like that.
No.
You know, you don't have to take Panadeine Forte or that's the slow-release Panadeine that a lot of people are on just because the doctor says, well, you're going to have pain because you're getting old, so maybe take this tablet.
That's right. You know? And the other thing about that is the structure of the language the doctor has used there is a Milton pattern. So what they're doing is they're taking the person's reality.
Right.
Yes, they are getting old. There's nothing they can do about that.
Mm.
Yeah? So they're pacing the reality. They're saying, as you get older, and the person goes, yes, I'm getting older, you will get pain. You will get more pain, sometimes they say.
Mm.
And the person goes, oh, okay. I've got to do that.
That's right.
So it's programming your neural pathways, programming your brain, programming your thinking to believe that that's inevitable. And so they have another birthday, and guess what?
They've got more pain.
Correct. Because they're doing what they're told. They're very obedient.
Mm.
And the unconscious mind is very cooperative. Yeah, it's very suggestible and very cooperative. So beware of what you suggest to people when you're working with them.
Right. Mm. And one last, I had a client who recently had a fall, and she's elderly. But unfortunately, the doctor said to her, when she was in hospital recovering from that fall, your next fall will be your last. And the poor woman was so upset. She said, what does that mean? Why did he say that? You know, so it's a bit like puts you into a total state of fear that she can hardly sort of move forward through without that. Do you know what I mean? So a really unfortunate or not unfortunate, almost negligent thing to say to somebody, you know, your next fall will be your last, you know, as in this is, there's a very finite thing happening here sort of thing. And it's not far away sort of, you know. So I think it's really important that we, to understand the language we use with our clients. Now, you, so people doing an NLP entry-level course, is there something that people can do to sort of, as health practitioners, that we get in and sort of to learn about the language that we could use around our clients?
Yeah. I mean, generally I would recommend that people do a practitioner training, and that's a seven-day training.
Mm.
But with a seven-day training, you will know, you will understand the language patterns, and you will be able to use the language patterns appropriately with clients. Some people go on and do a master practitioner as well, which is another 10 days training. And that's more immersion in it. And really, when you when you want to build mastery and create potentially your own NLP techniques, yeah? But the practitioner training is a really awesome training to do when you're working with clients.
Right.
We, you know, I do run webinars on and shorter programs online, which is just an introduction for people to kind of get their head around the basics. So there, I offer them from time to time.
Well, that's great. Can we put those into the show notes perhaps so that people can access those and have a look and see what goes on there?
Definitely.
That'd
definitely
be really good.
Yeah, but the seven-day practitioner training is, you leave the training room being able to use the techniques.
Right.
And with my trainings, I guarantee the training. And what that means is when you've done it once, you can rejoin the training at any time in the future to brush up or practice, or and all you pay for then is your catering costs.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, because my success criteria as a trainer is that my the people who've trained with me are using the techniques. I want you to be using the techniques. So I'm there to support people who've done the training so they're out there using them, because I'm very passionate about making sure our language is one that empowers rather than disempowers people.
Yeah. That's so important. I think so. If we can add language, and often the way the person leaves your clinic with the last thing you say to them perhaps can be very important.
Yes.
Just as we say with basically the last procedure, if you like, that we do from a bone, it continues to work within the body for some time.
Yes.
Perhaps the language is even going to last longer.
Yes.
If we give them a belief, or perhaps give them some language around that they're going to improve, get better, rather than you're going to expect more of this pain.
Absolutely, absolutely. Just one little anecdote I had from, which was actually from the conference, from the dinner at your conference, was one of the Bowen therapists was talking about a patient who didn't believe that she could control the pain. And so this, what we talked about was if she asked them, what colour, if the pain had a colour, what colour is it? And if the client says blue, and then you say, what would it feel like if you made it red? And so they make it red. And then you say, what would it feel like if you turned the volume up or turned the volume down? What do you notice about that? And then you just leave it at that, because unconsciously the client has changed their pain.
Right.
So you've now taught them that they can change the pain. Yeah? You haven't told them they're wrong. You've just taught them that they can change their pain, and unconsciously that's a new belief that they then get to play with.
It's really exciting stuff, isn't it?
It is,
and it must be a conversation we've got time for today, I think. But it might become, we could come back into the future and revisit it. But certainly if you can give us some information that we pop into the show notes, because people listen to the Bowen Buzz internationally, so this is something that can be taught face to face internationally, but there is also some online stuff that people can do.
Great.
Look, thanks for your time today.
My pleasure.
Fascinating.
Thank you,
conversation.
Chris.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this has been Chris here with Joanne Clark from Destiny Pursuit on the Bowen Buzz. Enjoy the buzz. You've been listening to another episode of the Bowen Buzz podcast. So I hope you've enjoyed that. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest someone we could interview, please let us know by going over to the comments page. And if you'd like to leave a review on iTunes, that'd help us get the word out there and spread the news about the Bowen Buzz podcast. This has been Chris Reed. Have a great day. Enjoy the buzz.